do you mean by triage? What's the difference between diagnosis and triage? Diagnosis is a situation where you firmly rule out disease or confirm disease. Okay? Triage is a situation you pass people with a high probability of disease to a diagnostic pathway. They themselves are not diagnostic, but they will help the diagnostic pathway. So this is the definition of triage. Many investigations that we do in clinical medicine are triage. For example, physical examination is the most widely used triaging examination, which is increasingly disappearing now. Okay? So somebody comes with a symptom of fever or abdominal pain, what you do? The first thing you do is physical examination. That is a triaging investigation. And that physical examination leads you to say, oh, I will order for Ridol. Oh, I will order for C-reactive protein. Oh, I will order for ultrasound of the liver. Okay? So that is the one which leads you to do further triaging investigations. And then finally, it leads to a diagnostic test, which is histopathology, which is the most sensitive diagnostic test at the moment available. But for not every situation which will demand a histopathology, sometimes it could be a Vidal, it could be a biochemical investigation. Sometimes it could be an imaging investigation. For example, for tuberculosis, quite often the diagnostic investigation is an X-ray of the chest. Okay? Because you won't be able to demonstrate the TB bacillus in everyone's sputum unless they are open cases. So here, colposcopy as a triaging investigation, what it means is, we already said when you screen people, you divide people into screen positive people and screen negative people. Screening is an investigation, it's a test, which is a very simple test which can be applied to a large number of people, which is affordable, which is acceptable, and after its application, it divides people with a high probability of disease and a low probability of disease. Okay? Screening test is not a diagnostic test. So pap smear is not a diagnostic test. It's a screening test. When you apply it, it divides people with a high probability of disease. So who are the high probability of disease? People with a pap smear result of ascus, a pap smear result of L-cell or H-cell or cancer. All the others, you know, okay, no problem, you go home. And when you do visual examination, VIA positives are at high probability of disease. When you do HPV test, HPV positive people are all high probability of disease. But even in those high probability of disease, many people won't have disease. So many are falsely positive. So by triaging investigations, we are avoiding those people with a false positive screening test from further diagnostic investigations and further treatment. So by triaging, you are avoiding harm to a large number of people. When you do an unnecessary diagnostic investigation, when you do an unnecessary treatment, there are harms associated with that. Okay? So we are avoiding. A triaging investigation avoids harm. So for colposcopy, so what are the indications for colposcopy? Anybody who is screen positive. So pap smear positive, or HPV positive, or VIA really positive. In the case of pap smear, the positivity can be defined at different thresholds, at different levels. If you go to Europe, they take L-cell, H-cell, and cancer as pap smear positive. Okay? Go to United States. And if somebody is ATPR, ask us. They don't take them straight away. They ask for additional investigations. Now they do HPV testing. But in India and in developing countries, in our view, a pap smear positivity starts at ascus because the quality, the level of pap smear in many of our countries is so bad. Any abnormality on pap smear, we will take it as positive. Okay? Is there any pathologist here? They will shoot me, you know?
Right?
And it is not a criticism. You know, similarly, I will say the same criticism with colposcopy in a moment. So these are the indications for colposcopy, and there are certain conditions for a satisfactory colposcopic triage. Whenever you do colposcopy, it is imperative that you should see the squamocolumnar junction in its entirety. Usha told you, and Srebani also mentioned this morning, the transformation zone is something which is immediately close to the squamocolumnar junction. That's the most identifiable limit of the transformation zone. The transformation zone should be fully visible to make a satisfactory colposcopic assessment. If it is not fully visible, the colposcopy is unsatisfactory. So whatever conclusion you make out of that colposcopy is limited in value. And even if the squamocolumnar junction is fully visible, if there is a lesion, the lesion should be fully visible. The limits of the lesion should be fully visible. Okay? So that is also another important criteria which is seldom emphasized in textbooks. The textbooks always will say squamocolumnar junction, fully visible transformation zone. Full visibility of the lesion is also a very important criteria. Now one of the big problems in medicine now is whatever you want to do, the choice of the equipment or the choice of the test or choice of the consumable. We said HPV testing in the morning. You know, there are more than 300 tests available in the market. So which one you will choose? So that's always a big issue. You talk about colposcopes. There are many, many models available. So what type of equipment you will choose? The choice of the equipment will depend upon the use of the equipment. Okay? So first we will see the use. It's a routine field program or routine office colposcopy. Okay? And your routine service colposcopy. This is the most common use, isn't it? So for such use, you will always choose an office type of colposcopy. In fact, what I have shown here is an office type of colposcopy, you know, which is very vertical. Anything which is vertical, you know, doesn't go this way, doesn't go swiveling, you know, fit in the roof and then swiveling arms and then bend it close. These are all, don't go for them. They are very cumbersome, you know. I don't know about you people, I find it even now very difficult, you know, to adjust a swiveling colposcope. So, anything which is cumbersome, very heavy, moves here and there, don't go for. Okay? Go for something which stands very vertically. So, this is an office type of colposcope. And which is very simple, light. And if you want, you can dismantle it, put in a bag and then you will be able to take it. So, this is another important criteria that you should apply. And of course, you should also look into the cost, the cheapest. An office type of colposcope has certain features. Okay? It has an optic carrier, which is at the top of the vertical end of the colposcope, which has the eyepieces, the optics, the lens, and all those mechanisms on top, through which you binocularly visualize the cervix, adjusting to your interpupillary distance. We'll all demonstrate this tomorrow when we have the equipment. How many of you do colposcopy here? Can you put up your hands? How many? 1, 2, 3, 4. How many have seen a colposcope? How many? Okay, not more than half have seen the colposcope. So this is a good thing for us to know, you know, because to demonstrate the equipment in right earnest, how you focus and all those things. So we will deal with that in practice. So through the head of the colposcope, through the optics, you visualize the cervix binocularly, adjusting the eyepieces to your interpupillary distance and keeping the colposcope at its correct focal length. Anything you use a lens, it is a focal length, isn't it? Otherwise, it will be blurred. So most of the colposcopes will have a focal length of 30 centimeters. There are colposcopes which are less than 30 centimeters. Always you should go for a colposcope where the focal length is like 30 centimeters, between 30 and 35 centimeters. You know why? If it is too close, then you are too close to the patient. It is not very hygienic for you. And then it is very little space between the colposcope and the patient. You know, you want to do take a biopsy, you will knock on the equipment. You know, all types of inconvenience. And if it is too long, 50 centimeters, then you have to go with something, you know. Right? So don't, so this is a very important practical point. So go for a colposcope which is 30 centimeters in focal length. Very, very important. And then there are several adjustments with the colposcope. You know, in some places, you see the couches will be very high. There is no way you can reduce the height of the colposcope, the couch. In some places, it will be too low, so you'll need bricks to keep them, you know, at an appropriate level. So you have to vertically increase the height or reduce the height of the colposcope. So that should be by means of very simple knobs, so that it is very smoothly goes up and down. And then, the entire head of the colposcope has to be, you know, aligned. So it should have movements which are very simple, which you can do with handles which are very simple, and the same handle also gives the fine focus. The way you focus the colposcope is, if the focal length is like 30 centimeters, you bring the colposcope to near to about 30, 31 centimeters, and then use the fine focus to get the image very clear. Okay? So in order to do that, the colposcope should be mounted with a pedestal, with a moving pedestal, with swivel wheels. Quite often, this is the big problem. You know, there are many things which will be very difficult to move. So it is something, you should choose a colposcope where the movement is very simple. You know, it doesn't get stuck up. The wheels don't, you know, they don't run off. So something which is very sturdily mounted. Then the colposcope has a light source, okay? A bulb. And the light source is very important. That is the one which gives adequate light to visualize the cervix. I would prefer a colposcope where the light source is in the head itself. And there is a very simple opening through which you can open and remove the bulb when it is no longer works and replace it. So it is very simple. Okay? There are colposcopes available like that. And which uses the ordinary 15 rupees, 30 rupees bulbs, you know, not specialized bulbs. So this is where the manufacturers make money. If it requires a very specialized bulb with a very special adapter, you have to only buy from them. How much it costs, Evelyn?
$25.
But on the other hand, there are colposcopes where you can buy the bulb in the market for 15 rupees, 30 rupees. So these are the type of colposcopes I would go, even in the vertical models. As far as possible, you should try to avoid. These are type of colposcopes where the light source is here, okay? And there is a light switch. And the light is transmitted through a power cord to the head. The problem is, this is very fine, nice, no? It's very sophisticated, nice. But the thing is, you improperly handle the colposcope, this power cord can break, and no longer the light will go to the head. So either you have to replace it, or you have to replace the whole system, or you have to throw the entire equipment. So this is how the manufacturers make money. So if you go for such things, use it very carefully so that you don't break the power cord. Right? I'm not an agent of any company, okay? When I make this statement, I have nothing to do with any company. Right? There are colposcopes available from India, from China, from Brazil, from this low middle income countries, which are very sturdy, where the light source is on the top of the machine. So an office type of colposcope can be bought anywhere between, say, $1,200 to $2,000. This is for your field use, your office use, your routine use, and things like that. If you are in a teaching department, like in a medical college, or in a colposcopy service where you are acting as a preceptor and you train people, then there are two types of colposcopes that you can use. One type of colposcope is with a teaching side tube. With a head, there is a side tube and there is a lens. So you do colposcopy and the student stands next to you, looks through. It is uniocular. It is not monocular. It's uniocular. It's monocular. It's not binocular. But still, they will be able to see the colposcopic features and learn with you. The advantage is, it is an optic image. Okay? An optic image is always better than a digital image. You agree with me? Especially in endoscopy. The disadvantage is, when two people use, the light source is divided. So it is less illuminated. The second option, which I prefer, I think my colleagues may also prefer, I think, is a digital colposcope with an eyepiece and a screen and a computer. Okay? There are digital colposcopes without the eyepiece. You know, you just go blindly and then you show and then the image comes in. We don't prefer that. It is always better to tune your eyes. At the same time, you get the digital image. There are many colposcopes available. These are good for teaching a group of people. But again, when you choose this, you have to be careful. When you examine the system, you have to see whether this type of video colposcopes, how do they resolve the different colposcopic features? One of the most difficult colposcopic features to resolve in digital imaging is the vascular features, what we call as mosaics, punctation, atypical vessels and things like that. Generally, most of the digital colposcopes are limited in showing these features very distinctly on the screen. But there are equipment which shows such features very nicely. So that is something you have to be careful when you choose your equipment. And usually by negotiation, you can buy a video colposcope anywhere between, say, 200,000 to 600,000 rupees. So this is for a teaching department. And then, of course, as Dr. Usha showed this morning, you should also have the colposcopic adjunctive instrumentation ready on a tray. So there are several things that you require. You require the consumables like acetic acid, normal saline, leucocidin, the Monsell space to control bleeding, and a bottle with formalin or whatever fixative that you use in that hospital, all assembled with the cotton swabs, a kidney tray, with the speculum, and all the instruments which are needed, you know, from the sponge holding forceps to your biopsy punches, sterilized and kept ready on a sterilized linen cloth. So this should be readily assembled. And whenever you do a colposcopic procedure, you should take advantage of the time and the availability of the patient. If there is an indication for treatment, you complete the treatment also in the same sitting. Okay? This is another form of treatment. They call it a see and treat. The woman is there, you are doing a colposcopic procedure, and you have colposcopic abnormalities detected, and you do a colposcopic triaging into a probable high-grade lesion, a probable low-grade lesion, or a probably invasive cancer, preclinical invasive cancer. And if it is a probable high-grade lesion, probable low-grade lesion, that is your triaging conclusion, then you use that opportunity to do treatment. If it is a completely necrocervical lesion, it's a small lesion, you direct a biopsy, cold coagulate or cryofreeze, or you have a laser, you laser destroy. If it is a large lesion, it is going into the canal, or you think, oh, that's a possibility of invasion, you excise. Or you think, this is likely to be a glandular lesion, you know, a lesion, a precancerous lesion of the columnar epithelium. In the morning, we discussed only the precancerous lesions of the squamous epithelium, because visual inspection is something which will detect lesions only on the visible part of the cervix. And in fact, most of the screening tests are highly ineffective against detecting lesions which occur in the columnar epithelium because it is inside the canal. So quite often, the precancerous lesions of the columnar epithelium, which are called adenocarcinoma in situ, are diagnosed by excising, blindly excising the endocervix and a very competent pathologist examining by several sections. So it requires diagnosing precancerous lesions of the endocervix requires a very sophisticated system. So I always used to say a day-to-day colposcopy is something which diagnoses 70% of the lesions which are looking at you. You will still miss 30% because it is again a subjective procedure. And quite often people are, as compared to other endoscopic procedures, you take bronchoscopy, take esophagoscopy, gastroscopy, colonoscopy, okay? Compared to all those endoscopic procedures, the colposcopy is much more dynamic. It has much more correlation with histology. You know what the histopathologist says as CAN3, what the histopathologist says as adenocarcinoma in situ with visible features on the ectocervix, invasive cancer, they all have different colposcopic characteristics, which we will see as we go on today. So it's a much more dynamic colposcopy as compared to other endoscopies. Okay? But it has been, in recent years, it has been heavily criticized. Part of the criticism is the tendency to make it as a very sophisticated procedure. Colposcopy is not a sophisticated procedure. It can be done in the office by a competent provider who can be a gynecologist, who can be an ordinary doctor, and who can be a nurse. By proper training, proper exposure and learning curve. So nurse colposcopies are now very common. If you go to the British NHS now, 80% of the colposcopy is carried out by nurse colposcopies. And then the difficult cases the doctors see. But of course, they have training and things like that, accreditation. And in fact, one of our major programs in the South is run, 90% of the colposcopy is carried out by nurses. Only 10% the doctors do, you know, where there is an assessment of the endocervix, whether there is a more complicated lesion and things like that. So with proper training, the colposcopic triage can be easily done by a large number of providers. Then coming to the colposcopy examination steps, essentially you have to expose the cervix and you have to focus the colposcope and examine the features of the cervix, you know, without applying anything first. And quite often in a classical procedure, people will apply normal saline before applying acetic acid and lugolside. Nowadays, we discourage this. The moment you induce bleeding in the cervix, your visibility is compromised. So more the time you manipulate the cervix, and especially in developing countries, because there is quite a lot of inflammation, and with inflamed cervix, bleeding is so easy. To make it bleed is so easy. So lesser you touch the cervix, better. For this reason, nowadays we don't advocate normal saline. Straight away go and apply acetic acid, assess the cervix, and then apply lugolside and assess the cervix, and then you decide directing biopsies or excision or treatment or whatever it is. So we are going to divide the colposcopic features into three lectures here. I'm only going to talk about the normal colposcopy, why the colposcopy is satisfactory, and what are the normal features. You don't detect any abnormality. So at the end of the colposcopic procedure, you are making a colposcopic triage conclusion of everything is normal, doesn't require any more intervention. In this particular situation, the triaging colposcopy becomes a diagnostic colposcopy. You have diagnosed, there is nothing abnormal, and you are sending. Okay. In a situation where you are going to direct a biopsy, the colposcopy is still triaging. It is the biopsy which is going to determine, as a diagnostic procedure, the histopathology, which is going to say whether it is a lesion or everything is normal. So it is very repetitive now. These are the appearances of squamous epithelium, the normal blood vessels, columnar epithelium, the squamocolumnar junction, and transformation zone. The only difference is, in the naked eye, it is much more simpler. You are not confused. Here, you are magnifying. So you will be confused. So you have pitfalls, you fall down. Because you misinterpret many of the normal things as abnormal. And you have a pitfall. The second pitfall is, Many of the abnormalities you don't recognize and you think it is normal. So there are two pitfalls possible here. And this is the first time I mentioned about magnification. I didn't say anything about magnification when I described the equipment. I had a specific reason. If you want to assess anything, you have to see that particular thing in total. This is like our television image, you know. So it's only one half, so everybody is fighting, you know. You don't show the other place, you know. A selective image always misleads. So the ideal colposcopic assessment is done at a magnification of 4 to 6 times magnification. The whole cervix is seen. So any colposcopic equipment which gives even a single magnification of 6 times, 5 times, 4 times, good enough for office purposes. Okay? Then the larger magnification like 12 times, 16 times, 40 times is required only when you want to see a certain part of the cervix and then to assess that. It's not really necessary. Okay? All the colposcopic assessment can be done with a magnification of 6 times, 4 times, 4, 5, 6. That's all maximum which is needed. So for your routine work, even if you go for a single magnification, it is fine. But when you are in a teaching situation, go for higher magnification, in addition to this higher magnifications. And there, you can have a magnification at a continuous scale, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, like that. That happens with the digital colposcopes. With optical video colposcopes, it is a stepwise. 6, 12, 18, 40, like that. Okay? So for routine purposes, you don't require higher magnification than 6. And to assess the cervix, you always assess the cervix at a magnification, low magnification. Only when you need, you go for a higher magnification. The second colposcopic instrumentation feature I didn't mention at that time, I wanted to mention here, is the availability of the filters. There are green filter, blue filters, yellow filters. Normally, you need only one filter, which is a green filter. The purpose of the green filter is it makes the background of the cervix in such a way the vascular features are well seen. Okay? Normally, the vascular features are lost in the white or in the red or in the pinkish background. So these filters filter a certain, you know, wavelengths in the light and make the background very bland so that these vascular features will be seen black very nicely. So to assess vasculature, you need a green filter. There is no need for multiple filters. I am repeating. So here, as I said, all the pictures you saw in the morning is a magnification of 4 to 6 times. So they are not real visual inspection pictures because you cannot have real visual inspection picture taken. You won't be able to see any features. So as Usha said, we have defined the transformation zone. I'm not going to repeat. Huh? You see the original scamacolumnar junction, which is an imaginary line, and then the new scamacolumnar junction. Normally, whenever you just simply say scamacolumnar junction, it means the new scamacolumnar junction and the transformation limit. Quite often, this Usha was telling this morning, the way you identify the outer limit is, you know, you look for Nabothiensis or cliffs and you draw an imaginary line. Quite often, you won't be able to even see them in many people. So what we normally do is, the original squamous epithelium is pinkish in color. The metaplastic squamous epithelium, which is in the transformation zone, is pinkish white in color, somewhat pale. And the columnar epithelium is red in color. So here, this imaginary line is based on that subjectivity, right? And then again, here, the entire squamous column junction is visible. Thank you. And so this is the pinkish original squamous epithelium, which was from in utero. This is somewhat the pinkish white transformed squamous epithelium, which is the transformation zone. And this is the squamocolumnar junction. And this is the reddish. And you don't see any definite acetovoid area, no ulceration, nothing, it is normal. Okay? So here again, two color tones, the brown, black, and orangish tinge of the columnar epithelium after the iodine stain. If you do colposcopy in 100 women, you will see the normal vasculature maybe in 10%. In many people, you won't see any normal vasculature. You will see this tomorrow. Okay? Only in about 10-15% you will see the blood vessels. Okay? So these blood vessels have to be recognized from abnormal blood vessels later. We will talk about them later. The most common vascular appearance is what is called as a network of capillaries. Because normally what happens, you know, people are all inflamed, you know, especially in tropical countries. So inflammation always heals with vasculature, you know, excessive vasculation. These are all, they are in the stroma. You should understand, the epithelium doesn't have any blood vessels. They are all in the stroma. So this should be a situation where, because of repeated infection, the epithelium is thin, so that some of the substromal, subepithelial vessels are seen through the epithelium. That is how you see the normal vessels, okay? The usual pattern is the network of capillaries. Sometimes you see this hairpin capillaries, especially when there is inflammation. Staghorn vessels, there is inflammation. This is usually, you see this on the top of a Nabothian cyst. Because again, what happens on the top of the Nabothian cyst, the epithelium is thinned because of the stretching of the mucus. This is another thing which beautifully you see, you know, it is like a regular branching. Thick vessels, they branch into thin vessels. And these are parallel blood vessels. This is after healing, you know, after inflammation, after radiotherapy. Classically, if you examine the cervix, 6 months after pelvic radiotherapy, you will see this parallel blood vessels. This is the network of capillaries, you know. There are some parallel vessels as well. Network of capillaries. I mean, this is the usual vascular pattern that you see, as I said earlier. Then Usha explained this morning, both Usha and Shrabani, very clearly the metaplastic process. The second normal feature you see is metaplastic epithelium. Okay? Metaplastic epithelium is an epithelium which is a columnar epithelium which is changing into squamous epithelium. So there are different levels of metaplastic epithelium. In young women, you know, in their 30s, early 30s or late 25s, you will see this pattern. There's patchy areas of metaplasia happening, so that there is streaks of acetovitening. This is the squamocolumnar junction. Metaplasia is all happening here. These streaky metaplastic areas then coalesce to form a thin layer. Okay? So this is the second level. Then these thin layers coalesce to form tons of metaplastic epithelium, snow white, translucent, you can see through, with islands of columnar epithelium seen in between. That is the third level. And then they further coalesce so that the tongues move much more forward, you see. And usually the metaplastic tongues always point towards the os, centrifugal. Whereas dysplastic tongues are centripetal. They always are in the opposite direction. So this is another thing you should keep in mind. One of the ways you avoid, just like a pathologist is very difficult to differentiate an immature squamous metaplastic epithelium from an invasive cancer. Pathologist is always worried. The pitfall for the cytologist is again the same thing. The immature metaplastic cells are difficult to recognize from high-grade squamous intraepithelial cells. That is why they pitfall, you know. For the colposcopist, again, an immature colposcopist will say, oh, this is dysplasia, this is precancerous lesion. So the way to learn is when you are beginning, take biopsies from even some of these normal features and go and sit with the pathologist. One of the very important things for good clinical practice is your close collaboration with the pathologist and the imagiologist. You should always should go and discuss things and see, oh, what is this imaging feature of this particular disease that I encountered? Go and discuss with the pathologist. And quite often you will have discrepancy. Oh, I vouch this is high grade disease. Pathologist says, oh, this is metaplasia. Oh, so come on, show me. So call this person back. That is how the learning curve improves. And then finally, the whole thing coalesces. A Nabothian cyst is formed. The scleroglomerular junction is moved in. This is mature metaplasia. When mature metaplasia, no problem. Even for the colposcope, is no problem. Pathology is no problem. Because it is exactly like a squamous epithelium, original squamous epithelium. So this is just to show a biopsy which has been directed somewhere here, okay? So you have the metaplastic epithelium, snow white, milky white, milky snow milk. What's it called? What's the milk we call it? Rose milk, you know? Rose milk type of epithelium here. You can see through. A biopsy has been directed. So the mature squamous epithelium here, this is the future that you have. The architecture is fully intact. And this is the immature squamous metaplasia where there is no architecture at all. Cells are all distributed here and there. Suppose you send this tissue to the pathologist will be very everywhere immature cells, you know. So high-grade squamous CAN3, that's a pathologist's diagnosis. So proper directing biopsies and giving proper clinical information is also important. Otherwise, quite often they have to work blindedly. Okay, similarly here, you see the metaplastic process. And immature colposcope is again pitfall. They will confuse this with invasive cancer. If you bring Western colposcopes for the first time to Africa or Asia, Latin America, they will diagnose quite a lot of invasive cancer because they have never seen inflammation as much as the inflammation we see. Inflammation is, you know, the way that you diagnose inflammation colposcopically is inflammation is not restricted to the transformation zone. Dysplasia is restricted to the transformation zone. It is widespread. So there are colposcopies, atypical vessels everywhere, inflammatory vessels. So these are areas, you know, where the pitfall can happen. You know, immature colposcopies, this is a cervix where it is highly inflamed. Probably there was quite a bit of an inflammation. And there is quite a bit of an exposure of the columnar epithelium. So vaginal acidity and all those things. So extensive metaplastic process. So again, you know, so you have applied Lugol-Cidin, you applied acetic acid, there are no acetovite areas. So both assessments together can exclude quite a bit of an abnormality. So you exclude dysplasia and then arrive at a diagnosis of a normal cervix. Again, just to show the advancing tons of the metaplastic epithelium. So with different magnifications, okay, 8 times magnification, it's even higher magnification, all the tons are pointing towards the os. And then this is with the filter, with the green filter. And as I said earlier, you know, you don't see in any of the images any normal vascular patterns. Okay, this is even more magnified, 40 times. So, it is complete mature metaplasia here. So, scleroglomerular junction is just at the os. By manipulation, you may be able to see better. Multiple Nabothian cysts, button-like acetovitening. Multiple button-like acetovitening. When you see this, puncture all of them, okay? Will you puncture a Nabothian cyst? Previously, it was the teaching. And it took several years for gynecologists to learn. This takes a long time to heal. My gynecology teacher in those days used to tell, when you see a Nabothian cyst, puncture it. I'm not joking, it's true. Many gynecologists still do. So, this is postmenopausal epithelium. After 45, colposcopic interpretation is very difficult. As explained by Srabani this morning, the epithelium degenerates, it becomes like 8 or 10 layers maximum, and it is lacklusterous, and it is brittle, with slightest touch of bleach, and it produces less glycogen. So it appears very pale. So the interpretation of aceto whiteness and the interpretation of mustard yellow appearance in a postmenopausal epithelium is difficult. So for the same reason as VA, VA is a very unsatisfactory screening procedure in postmenopausal women. Colposcopy is very unsatisfactory in postmenopausal women. Not only because the non-visibility of the entire transformation zone, because of the brittleness of the epithelium. Still you struggle, you know, you have to make. So this is a normal postmenopausal epithelium, you know. The glycogen production is not there, so that is why you have this variegated appearance. There are patchy areas of glycogen production, which looks black or brown, and then the mustard yellow areas. So this variegated appearance is characteristics of either postmenopausal epithelium or extensive inflammation. So this is another classical example, HKA. Even with the slightest manipulation, the substromal blood vessels bleed. Okay? You bleach the epithelium here. Okay? Either the stroma is exposed, which appears as a petechiae, or there is real bleeding of the stromal blood vessels. This is highly characteristic of postmenopausal epithelium. The pitfall rate is high, but still you have to assess it. Okay? So I stop here.